Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I'm your host, John Naster, and I'm looking forward to this, to bringing this to you. So let's just get into it. My guest today is the founder and CEO of Cochava. It's a technology company that's now integrated into more than 3,500 networks and publishers and is trusted by the biggest companies in mobile gaming, news and media, and consumer goods. For nearly 20 years, he has been creating technology and building companies around them. He began his career at Oracle and later held executive C-level positions at M-Code, Managed Objects, and Play Expert. In this conversation, we discuss what it's like to start a side hustle before side hustles were a thing, and why he felt behind when starting his first company, and then also how he overcame this. Now, let's hack. Charles Manning. When it comes to marketing your business, or when it comes to marketing your new product or service, it's all about reaching the right audience at the right time. And it's about connecting them with the message that will resonate with them the most. So if you want to target your customers where they are every day, and if you want to target them when they're ready to make a decision, LinkedIn can help you. When you advertise on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers. Right? What's the first step? It's talking to the right audience. Well, every day, over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn, and chances are your future customers are amongst them. LinkedIn has the marketing tools you need to help target your customers with precision. And the best part is, you can start for free right now. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, go to linkedin.com/hack. That's linkedin.com/hack for your free $100 ad credit. Yet some terms and conditions apply, but head over to linkedin.com/hack right now to get started with your $100 ad credit. Are you ready to grow your audience? Then do it with email. When done right, your email list will become your biggest asset. Thankfully, ConvertKit makes it easy. Using their attractive forms or trackable data, it's a simple but powerful email automation service that will increase conversions through automated emails that feel personal. And if you want to try out ConvertKit, you've heard of it, you've read about it, you've seen all of these things. Now, if you want to try it for 30 days absolutely free, this is how you do it. You go to hacktheentrepreneur.com/convert. That's going to get you free 30 days, no matter what subscription level you want to try. To start now with ConvertKit for 30 days free, go to hacktheentrepreneur.com/convert. We're back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very special guest, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, John.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. I believe we're going to have a lot of fun, so I'm looking forward to this. Let's just jump into it, Charles. Charles, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Yes, good question. So there's a few ways to interpret the question. In the context of how you asked specifically, what's the one thing you do, present tense, that has contributed, past and historical tense, to being an entrepreneur? And I think there's one answer to that, and there's another answer perhaps to kind of history and what was my environmental that caused it. I'll answer the environmental piece first because it paints a picture. As a young boy, I had a very entrepreneurial family. While both my parents were in higher education, historically, they both very much demonstrated entrepreneurial behaviors. Whether that was it wasn't really called this when I was younger, but kind of their side hustle, the things that they were always thinking about at the time outside of their full-time job. Or in the case of my mom was a fabulous entrepreneur who saw an opportunity during the deregulation of telecom to build a business. And it was when I was in a very formidable time period in my life, just kind of upper elementary school, middle school, lower high school kind of ages, that I had the opportunity to kind of hear the triumphs of success and the laments of absolute failure on a nightly basis at dinner. And when you experience that as the child of a family with an entrepreneur, one or both in the family, you really hear that not everything is as sexy as it appears to run your own business, quote unquote. And equally, not everything is as terrible. You just have to build a little bit of adversity training, as my father-in-law always talks about. And so that really contributed a lot to my history in that I saw that firsthand. I visited my mom's business daily, weekly basis, obviously met different folks on the team, started to kind of wear it, kind of wear a new shirt or new pair of pants, and you kind of see how you fit in them. I think as a young boy, you kind of learn what are the things that I really like about this or I don't like about this, just like you do with everything in life. And the one thing that was really interesting that both my parents really advocated when I was in high school is I'd talk about what I wanted to do for college and after college. They always said, you work for a big company when you leave college. That's really what we suggest you do because you've spent your entire life hearing what it's like to be a founder or an entrepreneur. And it would be great for you to see what it's like to work for a very big company because any entrepreneur that is worth their weight in salt wants to build that business and to be something that's as big as that big company. And you need to be able to have an opportunity to see both sides of that spectrum. So that's how I would answer kind of that former question. On the latter question, what are the things that I present tense do that kind of help contribute to that dynamic of being an entrepreneur? I would say I think there are times when I would attribute that to just a general neurosis. And I say that, right. I say that in a very self-defeatist way because there are times where I just feel so much like, gosh, can I ever do anything right? Can our team ever do anything right? And it's not at all true. We're doing tremendous things fabulously, and there's a lot to be thankful for and a lot to be grateful for. And people are really giving things their all, and it's really exciting. And then, but that neurosis, I would equate to just a feeling that we're not done. And I think Zuck has done a good job at socializing that we're 1% of the way. Concept, or maybe that was Jeff Bezos, actually, the 1% dynamic. And maybe it's both of them. I actually don't know who to attribute that to. I remember that phrase in both cases. But I think that theme is similar in that there's still a lot to do. And let's not get too comfortable saying that we are an established company and therefore we can just sit and ride. I mean, things are constantly changing and you're either growing a business or it's not growing. And as an entrepreneur, even if you're the CEO of a very small company with one person or two additional people, or you're the CEO in the case of Kochava, you know, we've got 140 people with a few different tiers of lieutenant staff, or you're a C-level person in a 30,000 person company. At the end of the day, you have a dynamic that can be very entrepreneurial, and you can set a tone and a culture across the teams who look to you for leadership that we're not done yet. And these are the additional things that we need to do, that we need to grow. And I think that's the kind of present tense. What do you do that contributes to your entrepreneurialism? It's that sense that we're not done and there's a lot yet in front of us.
I like it. So there's a lot to unpack sort of in this, but I do this idea of what it's like to work for a big company.
Mm.
So you went to work for a big company?
I did. I went and I joined Oracle.
Yes, that is a big company.
Right after college. Yeah, and it was like I wanted at the time, you know, this is 1995, 1996. So I'm a little older, but at the time where you would work would be like Sun. If you were interested in the things I was interested in and you had a coding background and like all those things, you'd work for Sun or you'd work for Oracle or you'd work for Microsoft and potentially it would be someone else, but those are the big companies, right? Those were the big tech companies that would give that data point.
What do you learn by working at a big company?
Well, I know what I learned, and I don't know that it's what everyone else would learn. Look, I had roommates who were really great guys because, like, you know, you can't afford when you come out of school to live anywhere alone, especially in the Bay Area, even at that time. But I know when I joined Oracle, my takeaway was I really, and maybe this is like foolishly altruistic, but I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to figure out how this company operates. Now, mind you, I am right out of school and I am the lowest person on any possible totem pole that could exist, you know, because I'm coming out of school. But I very much felt like this was a company I was going to now understand the dynamics of. And I remember a few things. One was having the parents that I did. I guess I thought, even though I was in tech and I knew the things that I knew about tech, and I knew what my core job was, which was to kind of work with Oracle clients who were getting Oracle tech deployed for them. So I was on the consulting services side of Oracle's business. So I helped deploy Oracle tech for Oracle clients. I was an associate, which is the lowest role in the scenario. And I remember having a fleet of suits, and I wore suits to work every day. And I was the only dude who was 21 in probably all of Oracle that wore suits every day. But I felt like that's what you do if you really want to get a hang of this. And I am kind of embarrassed saying this out loud right now. But the guy who was kind of the West Coast practice manager, he was like the guy who worked for Ray Lane. Ray Lane ran all of services at the time, and he's left Oracle obviously a long time ago. But this guy's name was Chuck Sheridan. He was a really smart guy. And I remember he obviously noticed that there was this kid out of school who was the new guy who was wearing suits every day, and he was probably the only one out of anyone. But so he took me out to lunch, and I was like, this is fantastic. I'm on my voyage of figuring out how Oracle works, and let's start on the services side of the business. And I think there is something really lovely about that kind of wide-eyed, bushy-tailed kind of attitude of, you know, I genuinely felt like I had every opportunity to do that. And I did. And part of that is kind of playing the part in terms of I cared that much about it that I wanted to be a big boy as opposed to a kid out of school. But I think the other part of it is I very quickly excelled because what I was learning in school was really about internet-based technologies, and Oracle as a company was really overloaded with client-server-related seniority in terms of tech stack. And so what was happening in 96, which was really interesting, was that the entirety of the tech space was transforming over from a client-server environment to this internet world. And all of a sudden, there were very, very big companies who had very big contracts with Oracle who were saying, okay, Oracle, you're my strategic technology partner. I need to make this internet thing apply and work to my business. Tell me what to do. And the answer was not coming from all of the senior folks who had been at Oracle for many years. It was coming from kids my age who were right out of school. And so there's this really interesting opportunity where all of a sudden I started leading projects, and the people on my team were people much more my senior. And it was part of that whole dynamic of, okay, this is fantastic. I'm learning the next stage of what it means that Oracle is operating the way it does. And I left the services side of the business after a little while and went over to the product side of the business because I really wanted to understand how a product business worked. And I worked in the app server group, which at the time was like the web server. That was the kind of the relevant internet side of the business that was just growing up at the time. And going back to the original question, what did you learn? I feel like it was such an awesome opportunity because I had this great chance to learn discipline and process and steps and proposals and large scale deals. I mean, I was on this team that did a prototype, and it was the first interactive TV system. And it was a proposal that we did for BSkyB. And we literally wrote the demo on the plane flying over to London. And it was me and these two other guys. And we stayed at the Hilton at Terminal 4 in London. And we were coding it on the plane and then continued to code it. And then we gave the pitch. And it was phenomenal because it was like in a startup, you would never get the entree and access to make such a proposal because no one would believe that you had the capacity to do it. But when you're Oracle, everyone believes. And because of this like confluence of forces that were happening with age and internet and transformation and desire and expectation and all this other stuff, I found myself in these really interesting circumstances that were really awesome. And I lapped it up. I thought it was terrific.
But still somewhere in this, you were like strategically sort of learning so that you could go out on your own at some point?
I was.
And build your own Oracle?
I was. I mean, I don't know that it was as clairvoyantly articulated as you described, but it was like, I want to build a big company, and software is always going to be the thing that's going to be around because that's the thing that I'm passionate about. I don't know what industry that's going to be in, and a database is required for every industry. And so it was like this awesome use case where, you know, I led a team that built the very first place where you could buy a cell phone online and have it delivered to you on FedEx or via FedEx. And it was for a company called AirTouch Cellular, who became over time through an acquisition strategy Verizon Wireless. And so the interesting thing that was happening at the time was you had all these regional cell phone operators. And I don't know if you remember this, when there was like roaming of your cell phone plan, and like you had to pick a spot where it was your home base and you'd get charged extra. Remember that ridiculousness? So we built this whole system that was done through the web without Ajax, you know, without any stateful responsive systems interfaces, like where you could like pick a zone, select where you'd want to have your roaming plan extend to, you'd designate a number all online, you'd pick the model and type of phone, and then it would get shipped to you pre-configured with an ESN number via FedEx. And that was an Oracle project that I led the team in building. And it was super, I met my wife on that project, super cool, because like every project was a first. We did the first subscription deployment system for virus definitions for Symantec. And we built that for Symantec and rolled that out. We built this interactive TV thing for BSkyB. That was just a prototype. But those are the kind of projects, and you just don't get that kind of opportunity cross industry, cross functional, unless you're with a big business like that.
So I'm looking back or thinking back to you in your 20s, just out of school, working for Oracle in your suit every day.
Right.
I'm wondering now, I mean, you are now leading a team of 140 people. Do you ever like look for that person? Mm. For somebody like that, who's like 25 years old, the only one wearing a suit. And you're just like, there it is. I need to like help that person or try and guide them in some way.
Yeah, I love it. I love that question. So I feel like there is a lot of genuine, well-intended people that join our business. And I think it is very endearing. And I would argue that I think to a certain extent, I'm gravitationally attracted to young people who really want to take a hold of what their future could be. And if they're interested in feedback, I want to help support them. Doesn't mean I'm going to personally guide them, because I don't know that I have the scale to be able to do that with each person. But like, I think we have a very capable young team who is more empowered than most teams as a result of that cultural dynamic that you're describing. There's also other spectrums to it. Like, for example, there's this really funny story, and I can't believe I'm sharing this publicly, but it's a great self-defacing story that just illustrates that everyone's human. And I'm certainly in that category. So I'm at a Christmas party, and it was two years ago, something like that. And there was a young man who worked for us who I didn't know his name. And that sometimes happens with some of the newer guys on the team. I haven't met them yet. I don't know their name. I haven't kind of interfaced with them. And it's okay. Like, I can't stop everything and learn everyone's name right off the bat. But I think over time that ends up building. Anyways, he calls me on it. And he was like, so Charles, here's a shot. You know, it's a Christmas party. He's got a shot of whiskey. He goes, have it. And I was like, no, I can't have shots. Otherwise, I get into trouble, because all of a sudden everyone wants to give me shots. And like, that's a problem. He's like, okay, tell you what. You drink the shot if you know my name. And he totally called me on it. And I was like, oh, dear, I have no idea. And I ended up taking the shot. And of course, I remembered his name from that point forward. And I'll tell you, that's a perfect example of someone who's wearing the suit, because, boy, would never forget the dude's name moving forward, obviously.
Right. So you do admire, and everybody else didn't line up and say, do you know my name? Here's a shot.
Thank God. No, they did not.
Because by the like fourth or fifth, you don't know anybody.
Right. Name. You wouldn't know anyone's name.
So have you, like, throughout this, was there mentors or guides that were like, that you actually had sat down with and created a relationship with in that way?
Yeah, good question. So while I was at Oracle, there were a few people who I really picked their brain. And the neat thing is these are all folks who were kind of lieutenant leadership at Oracle. And one of the great things is that Oracle spins out very capable leaders over time. I've learned, I didn't realize how potent it was as an org to do that. I wouldn't argue that I had some official mentorship relationship, but I think my attitudinal trajectory towards them was I listened to everything that they said. And even if they didn't think they were being listened to, they were being listened to. And so that happened a few times while at Oracle. And then later on, there were some folks who I had, you know, when I left Oracle, the reason I left was I felt like I was behind on starting a company. Now, that was obviously a goofy thing to think, but I just felt so impatient, even though I'd only been at Oracle for 2.5 years. And I really wanted to start a company. So I started my first company. And in retrospect, it was great. I probably can't imagine a scenario where I would have done it differently. But I think in retrospect, I would have suggested maybe give it another year and a half. If I was the trusted mentor to a young Charles Manning, I'd say, let's think about what are the other things you could and should do while at Oracle. But remember, this was like end of 98, beginning of 99. Things were crazy town in the Bay Area around a .com, eminent .com booming, right? And it was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gosh, this is a hot time. I need to go start a company. Everyone and their brother is doing something really interesting. And I just felt kind of, I think foolishly, like I was missing the boat. I'm glad I did what I did, but I started a company, built a neat product that is something I understood at the time, which was, you know, monitoring software for IT systems. And I raised a very small amount of money in the grand scheme of things and started selling the software. And we found some initial customers and they were actually buying the software. And I put together an initial team. And it was my first time that I kind of put all that together. And I did it in the Bay Area where it was super expensive and everyone else had lots and lots of money that they were raising funds with. And so it was like a first experience of you don't always have what you want to have. And it's not always like a super well-funded thing. You have to really believe in what you're doing and you have to be able to articulate what why you're unique and different and you have to be scrappy. And during that time, I had a few investors who were mentors who really gave me a lot of time. And I just thought it was so awesome because they gave me their money, but they also gave me their time. And then we talked a lot about the work that we were doing and the work that we were facing. And I think the only drawback was I felt so compelled to act like I had everything together that I wasn't necessarily positioning myself in an open enough position that I could hear more feedback than I already did. And what I mean by that is, I think because it was my first venture and I wanted to have it all together and I felt like everyone else in the world did, instead of receiving feedback and saying, well, that's a really interesting point. Let me see how I can flip this and do that. All feedback was really a critique of what decision I'd already made. And that's obviously not a position to be in when you really want to learn and listen and morph. While I appreciated the mentorship, I don't know that I took as much advantage of it as I could have. And I think that's just maturity. And over time, one learns to have more maturity and have ears to hear it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing because your first time in it, you're so worried about people finding out that you maybe
totally
don't know everything.
Totally.
And so like now, I mean, it's years and years later, but like how at what point throughout this did you realize that about yourself and like work to fix it?
Yeah, I don't think it was so we sold the company and that is a success, kind of ringing the bell and ticking the box to say, okay, company got started. We had revenue. We sold the company. I think that was great. And sold it to a company in the East Coast. It caused me and a few folks to go to the East Coast for that. And it was a great experience. I ended up running product management for this other company. It too was a private company. It wasn't a public company, but I got brought on to not only bring our product stack, but also to bring kind of myself and these other key members to kind of help augment the vision of this other company. And what was interesting about the other company was I worked for a woman who was the CEO of that other company. And for the first time in the recent past for me, you know, the last 2 years for me or year and a half while I had my own company, I didn't have to worry about payroll. I didn't have to be the CEO. I didn't have to worry about whether or not we needed to think about another round. I could use all of my knowledge and skill about tech and product and kind of, I always called it Trojan horse selling. Everyone's always selling, but you're not necessarily a salesperson. You're just articulating the merits of your product and you're kind of a Trojan horse seller. I was able to think about all those things and I wasn't constantly panicked about payroll or the next whatever. And it was during that time that I had a chance to really look back at my company that I started and cross-compare it with how this other company was being operated and run. And not having that worry gives you a lot of freedom to mentally think about what you did right and what you didn't do right and what you'd improve the next time. The other thing that I would attribute that to is my job was to run product management. Yes, that was my job. My job was to be almost a strategic Trojan horse seller to these key clients like Morgan Stanley and JPMC and Teachers Insurance. And so the seller was there, but I was like the guy who came in from product to say, you know, we're going to take care of you. I'm on the management team. We care about you strategically. We're going to meet all your needs. I know the salesperson can't make those promises, but I can. Let me walk you through how this is all going to be so beautiful and the future is so bright. Great. But the other thing it allowed me to do outside of those two things is to be a champion of my CEO. I worked for her and I had just gone through the experience of being a CEO. She was much more experienced. She was older. She was not 24 as a CEO. She was like a former executive at Computer Associates. She was very capable, but irrespective of her capability, I had the opportunity to really support her and to be her champion and to protect her in the context of like the way a good CEO should be protected in terms of what are these deal cycles? What should we be worried about in this context? What's happening organizationally that we can actually deliver on these things? So I had the chance to know the problems, but not have to be the final word on solving the problem. But I could equally be an advocate to support her as she made the right decision to solve the problem. And that gave me a ton of introspective perspective. It occurred to me during that time how important it was to have a trustworthy team that has your back as a CEO. And that it's easy when you're the CEO to feel like your team isn't supporting you. It's harder when you're the supporter to ask yourself, what am I doing to really make this person successful? And what can I do better to make their job easier? Because if their job is easier, the rest of this org runs easier. And it's not about, are you carrying your weight? And that, I think that's, I don't know that a lot of senior management remembers that importance of really supporting their CEO, but it was like an awesome opportunity for me. And I think it completely morphed, seeing both sides of that spectrum, it completely morphed my thought process about how do I really find the right kind of senior management that supports me over time, depending on the stage of the business. And I think that's a qualifier that is healthy to think about before you have to be in the position.
And I would say that you had reached definitely a significant level of maturity at this point.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of people who, like in that same situation, you're the CEO, founder of the company, it gets acquired, you go to another company, all of a sudden you're not the CEO, and it kind of irks them.
I know.
They're now not the boss, but you saw it as, this is a great way for me to like use both sides of what I know.
Yes.
And champion that person.
And you know,
that's maturity and humility right there.
I think you're right. I totally think you're right. I think that what was unique to me is that by doing that, my commitment to her as the lead, she saw that loud and clear. And all of a sudden, I had all sorts of latitude to do really interesting things, knowing that I've got her back. I want to make her successful. And so that was like a really nice, that was a nice outcome in terms of that dynamic. The other really neat thing that I can't help but bring up that I learned in that process was my company that I started, we raised a very small amount of money. I think it was sub $1 million. I mean, it was a small amount of money. And this company, when they had bought us, it was the existence of that company, they had just finished doing a $16 million B round. And so you can kind of get a sense of where they were in their trajectory. So they'd done a $16 million B round, and I think their revenues at the time were like sub $3 million annually. right? Remember, this is enterprise software. Mm-hmm. There's no SaaS. Like, that doesn't exist yet. Like, this is 2000. This is year 2000, because this is before 9/11 that this acquisition happened. And thankfully, we sold the company before kind of the dot-bomb exodus, you know, and huge problems. So it was really positive for us. It was positive for them. I ran product all the way through the point at which that company had $40 million in revenue. So from that sub $3 million to $40 million, and saw the team that built that out as an enterprise software, you know, on-premise software deployment system and org structure that was already there, as well as the org structure that continued to morph and grow. And I think what I didn't see at Oracle, and I didn't see in my mom's company in my youth, was that transitionary kind of venture-backed high-growth business. And boy, was that an interesting ride. And I couldn't have picked a better environment where I didn't have to worry about being the CEO in that circumstance, because I hadn't had that experience, but I got to watch it firsthand and learned a lot of important lessons and learned a lot of important details about what the venture community expects in terms of growth based on raises and things like liquidation preferences. And while I knew about them in principle, I saw them firsthand and in that company. So there's a lot of seasons to learn a lot of things as an entrepreneur, even when you're not the CEO.
Yeah, it's very, very true. And so we've talked up to this point. This is sort of leading up to where you were. Then for the last 7 years, Cochava has been your main focus as you've built that to over 140-person team, as we've said. So now that we've sort of looked through the past up to here, let's take Cochava sort of forward or to the present anyways with a discussion on projects within a 140-person growing team.
Yes.
So projects is usually a loose term, but you started a really interesting new project called Exchange. And rather than making it a completely separate entity, this is a project within a company that's been around for 7 years and growing. So I would love to know, as the founder, the CEO of this, how or what the process is that you go through and what the process is you go through as a team to decide that a project like Exchange is worth your time, energy, and resources?
Awesome question. Few clarity points. We absolutely incubated Exchange, and just for the sake of your audience, so Exchange is X-C-H-N-G, so it's the consonants, not the vowels. And the website is exchange.io, just for reference. And the story is as follows, and I've got some other things that I've written about on my blog that kind of talked about this a little bit to fill in some of these gaps, but there's some things I'll share that's kind of unique here. When I started Cochava, I had come off of having sold my previous company, which was in between these two companies that I just described, to a gaming business in the video game space. And we sold the company, which was called Play Expert, to Razer, which is a keyboard mouse company. Green logo. And today, Razer Comms is that Play Expert technology. It was a instant messenger tool that you could instant message your friends while in game. Sold that, but I wanted to stay in our kind of headquarters town of North Idaho, Sandpoint, and kind of do something else. So we started doing some consulting services projects just to kind of roll payroll and to be in the space of what agencies and brands care about. Great. Learned about this great opportunity where the measurement technology for the web wasn't applicable to mobile apps. So we built Cochava as an outcome of really listening to our customers and understanding that there is this really interesting opportunity around measurement and attribution to track the effectiveness of ad spend. Great. Fast forward about 5 years. So we build that business. It's building and it's growing, and things are going along famously. It's not without challenge, but we're building it. In, I'd say, probably 2015-ish timeframe, I personally become a little bit more interested in, I become interested in cryptocurrencies, and in particular, smart contract technology in the context of blockchain. And as the CEO of a measurement company, I immediately start applying how a distributed ledger framework combined with a smart contract system could be applied towards the buying and selling of digital ads, digital media, and that there was this really interesting kind of tectonic shift that I believed could happen as a result of blockchain against buying and selling ads. And it was the same kind of feeling I had when we started Kochava, where it was clear that while there was measurement technology for the web, there wasn't measurement technology for mobile apps. And it smelled, felt, looked as if we could build something that catered to the mobile app space, you know, 5 years prior or 4 years prior, that was comparable to what people were used to on the web space, and that we could build a really interesting solution that would cater to companies, provided that the ball moved in that direction. And in fact, it did. And it felt just like that 4 years later with blockchain, where it was like, this thing could be really huge. It could transform a whole bunch of different supply chains. If it does transform a whole bunch of different supply chains, one of the ones that it could really transform is one where the product is delivered digitally, which is the ad industry. And if it does transform it, I want to sit there with a catcher's mitt and just wait while it comes to us. But I have to know that we have to build the infrastructure in a way that's like useful. Great. So I remember talking to my team, my management team, saying, I know that things feel a little bit crazy and hectic and busy as we grow so significantly, but I want to take two of our top engineers and pull them to the side and build a blockchain prototype for digital advertising. And I nearly got tarred and feathered and crucified all in one fell swoop. Meanwhile, I cajoled it. We made it work. And we started playing around with these concepts. And we found some core problems with blockchain, in particular around speed of transaction volume. When you have a distributed ledger and you need to have a bunch of different nodes, n number of nodes that have to achieve consensus, and you have high volumes of transactions like in the space of digital ads, those two things don't typically mix. You know, Ethereum can handle like 10 transactions a second right now, just as an example, with their consensus model. So we started playing around with, well, how could we do this and have it be applicable to the volumes and speeds required for digital ads? Great. That was one of the key problems we wanted to solve. The other key problem we wanted to solve is to figure out, how do you apply a distributed ad server model to the existing ad industry? And we also applied that. Long story short, we didn't talk about any of this publicly. And the reason we didn't talk about it is we find that a lot of our competitors kind of use our direction as an input to where the roadmap is going and could be going in the industry. And so we just stayed really quiet and we invested. And this last October, and you might remember this last summer, it was like ICO crazy. That's really when blockchain became a known thing across the larger ecosystem of the world because of all these ICOs. And people were like, oh my goodness, people are like raising all this money. And that certainly was happening through last fall. And it became clear that we really needed to talk about what we were doing and make it known what we were doing so that we could send a kind of stake our claim of what we've been working on. So we did that and we came out with the website, video, and we've literally for the last 7 months been on like a nonstop evangelism tour talking about how blockchain can transform digital advertising. Now, that's the background, and that's an answer to your earlier question of how do you do that in an existing org. That's how we did it. I'm not sure that's the best way or the worst way. For us, that was what made sense to us because we wanted to continue to absolutely focus on our core business because it's not going away. And this is the key differentiator. Exchange is an open protocol-based system to buy and sell media. Kochava doesn't make any more money or any less money by having Exchange be deployed as this open system. But we believe the industry is going there. And so we want Exchange to be the framework or the rails or the tracks or the pipes on which that industry moves towards. And if it does, in addition to having built Exchange as a project, we've also built a whole bunch of really cool tools in core Kochava that leverage Exchange and are ways in which we can make more money by selling more product across a broader industry of people who use blockchain to buy and sell media with efficiency, transparency, and the absence of fraud. And so the really interesting jujitsu on this project of Exchange is that we're kind of building a framework for free and just contributing it out there in the world under the premise that we can sell train cars. You know, we're kind of building the tracks for this train system on the premise that we're selling electricity and train cars, but in an open way. So it's not a monopolistic way. Anyone can compete. We just happen to be the ones who are first to market because we designed the whole system.
Right. And in a way, I mean, it's obviously could never not be additionally beneficial to you as it grows. I mean, it is a Kochava project that started it. And it's like indirectly almost like a content marketing sort of
it is. That's a good way to put it.
You put out the free tools. I mean, companies do this all the time with like much smaller projects and don't always open source them. But I mean, even WordPress itself,
yes.
I mean, has, you know what I mean? It's that which drives the company because the awareness and whose hands it gets into.
You're totally right. And you know, the other thing, I was kind of making a comment to someone at a conference last week in New York. They were commenting like, oh my goodness, Charles, like I've seen you in 5 different keynotes in the last 2 months. And I was like, you're right. And guess what? No one asks anyone in the measurement space to be a keynote to talk about measurement, because like measurement's like toothpaste. You always need it, but it's not that sexy. It's, I mean, unless you're a weird propeller head geek like I am and a lot of our peers are, it's not that sexy. And so no one wants to talk about that as a keynote. Having said that, because we're the authors of Exchange and we've gone through, we had the insight and innovation to have actually design and build this, they want to hear from us. And we can just pepper in our leadership on measurement because it just happens to be there.
Very well said. I like that. I don't know how strategic that was, but that's going to definitely continue, I think, for you in a very measurable way.
Yes.
Going forward. All right, Charles. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I do want to wrap up on one final question for you, if I can.
Yep.
And it's something you've actually touched on near the beginning, which was when you couldn't quite put the quote to a name, but it was, there's still a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've interviewed almost 500 entrepreneurs now, and I've learned that I think we all feel like this, and this is what propels us forward. Yet, no matter what we seem to accomplish in our business or personally, we still oftentimes don't see ourselves as successful, meaning that we're projecting our success into that future, because we do have a lot to do, and I agree we need that. But rather than looking forward right now, Charles, I would like to take a minute, and if you could stop and turn around and look behind you at your entire career, or even from watching your parents starting side hustles years ago, I'm sure there's been numerous highs, lows, wins, and losses, but tell me how you feel about the entire journey up until today.
It is an incredibly insightful or thoughtful question. I think that the challenge that most entrepreneurs fall in is that sensation that they're not done yet gets interwoven into their identity. And by interweaving that into their identity, there can be a tremendous amount of potential depression because they have put so much into this thing and they've interwoven their identity that if that thing is not successful, it means they themselves personally are not successful. And I think it's a very easy thing to fall into. I am thrilled to share that I have been very intentional about kind of separating that my identity as a person, as a creation with a purpose, is what it is, and it's independent of those things that I put my hand to. I obviously am very passionate and I'm purposeful about putting my hand to these different things, but my identity is not found in those things. And I think, so that's the preface. To answer your question, as I look back, the greatest things that I am excited about, the greatest things that I am most grateful for, proud of, the things that I feel most not accomplished is probably the wrong summary descriptor, but really grateful for, is not about one venture experience versus another, but rather it's about, I am so grateful that I found my wife and that she was my partner and continues to be. And boy, am I grateful for that. Boy, she's put up with a lot with me. It's my kids, my family, and it's a very easy thing to say, well, my family is number one, you know, they're my life and whatever. And yet you spend all your time not actually demonstrating that through how much time you're investing in other things. And I think that balance is the struggle, is like finding that balance, but remembering where your identity is found. And your identity is not found in your work, and identity is not even found in your family, but it's but it's identifying what's valuable and what does have redeeming long-term value, and it's relationship, and relationship is not a venture per se. Ventures come out of relationships, but it's relationship. And so as I look back, I couldn't be more grateful. I feel like we've had a lot of success. You could put a bow on it, and it's been great. And yet, when I think about the opportunity of all the things that we can go conquer and accomplish, of course, we're not yet finished. And so we talk a lot internally. I'm sidetracking a little bit, but I talk a lot internally to our team in a lot of warlike metaphors. And perhaps it's just because it's the way I think, but I think it resonates with our team, and maybe we just attract people who resonate to those kind of concepts. But it's about what's the new territory that we're taking, how are we taking it, what's the strategy behind how we're taking it, you know, how do the tactics fall out of that strategy? And it's easy to forget that relationships matter when you talk all day long about these war metaphors of conquering. But I think that's the balance you have to strike, and it's caring about the people as well as the mission.
Very well said. Very well said. All right, Charles, this has been a blast. Kochava is the company we've talked about throughout the conversation. That's kochava.com. Exchange is at xchng.io. As well, you are blogging, I believe, over at Medium.
Yep.
I'll get a link to that. It's medium.com/Charles Manning or at Charles Manning, as well as a LinkedIn link I can find, and probably some general information on smart technology on the blockchain to kind of catch you up to speed. But Charles is really diving into it on Medium, so it's a great spot for you. I will get all those links over on Hack the Entrepreneur for you, so they'll be there waiting when you head over there. And Charles, once again, I do really want to thank you for stopping by. I want to thank you for sharing so openly. It really has been a great conversation. And just keep doing what you're doing, because it's awesome to watch.
Awesome. Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
So here we are, moving forward, as we always do. Yet maybe this time, like Charles, we should look back a bit. Let's go back through the conversation, and let's find that one thing that Charles said. You ready? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
I know when I joined Oracle, my takeaway was I really, and maybe this is like foolishly altruistic, but I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to figure out how this company operates.
And that's the hack. Charles, Charles, Charles. I love this. I love this because it obviously was foreshadowing and taught you so much to then go on and run effective companies. But I also love how you wonder if maybe it was like foolishly altruistic, just thinking like, how could you possibly straight out of school learn how a company the size and scope of Oracle runs? But it's that mindset of working within a company that works really well and learning from it, not just despising every second in it. And this is a fascinating conversation because of the fact that you did work in this company for a long time, and then you felt like maybe you had waited too long and you felt behind when starting your first company, but obviously you weren't, because look at what you've created. Look at what you've built since then. This is something that I think a lot of us miss, is that it's like the entrepreneurial gap, that even if you have a job and you're working, but you want to do and you want to start this business, don't use that time always looking forward and looking into the future of when that time comes. Take every moment that you have right now, wherever you're working, whatever it is you're doing, and learn everything you can about it. And maybe it's not Oracle, maybe it's not Google, maybe it doesn't matter. You can learn the way companies work in the good and also how they shouldn't be run. Just take notes, figure this stuff out, try and just suck up as much information about this as possible, because you can use this in the future when it's your turn. Charles, thank you so very, very much. One of my favorite parts of this conversation with Charles was when we get to talk about this idea of how he started a side hustle before side hustles were even a thing. Side hustles are now a thing, and they've always been a thing, just not termed that. And this is very appropriate, because actually today on the blog, hacktheentrepreneur.com/blog, we just published a great article about side hustle ideas, things that you can do on the side and make money and learn to start making money away from your job. If that sounds like something you're looking to do, then this article was written specifically for you. Go check it out, hacktheentrepreneur.com/blog. All right, it's been fun. I thank you so much for stopping by. It's really, truly appreciative, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You know what? Until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.